Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This is a Manhattan-bound B Express train. The next stop is Grand Street.
Mind the gap.
Hello, I'm John Ellich, and this is Skylines, the C-Metric podcast. Regular listeners will know that we've recently embarked upon a new sort of mini-series in which I go on exciting walks across the capital with people who want to be this fine city's mayor. There are, however, other mayoral elections happening elsewhere in this country at the same time in May. And to kind of act as a curtain raiser on that and the local elections more generally, I've got the New Statesman's politics editor, Stephen Bush, with me. Hello, Stephen.
Hello.
So, mayors, exciting. You excited?
I am, actually. I mean, I think so. There are lots of reasons why I'm excited about this set. And I've primarily been focusing on the outside London ones because...
We kind of know where London's going, don't we?
Well, I think it's not just that we know that Sadiq Khan will be re-elected. Yeah, so we know that Andy Burnham and Steve Rotherham are going to be re-elected.
But in Greater Manchester and the Liverpool City region,
yeah,
respectively.
But the sort of the fascinating thing is we know in London that we have a mayoralty that was created, yes, after Labour won the 97 election, promising to do it, but created after a referendum. There is a huge sort of level of buy-in to it as an entity. Now, the sort of fascinating thing about all of the other metro mayoralties which are up this year, which are, I'm almost certainly going to forget one or add
two
one
we've
on.
Mentioned, is Greater Manchester, Liverpool City region,
and then
West
there's the
Midlands.
One you're not allowed to describe as Greater Birmingham, even though that is what it is, because it's just like, it's not West Midlands. Like, so much of the West Midlands is not in it. It is Birmingham and its surrounding conurbation.
Well, yeah, there's always been that weird thing with, like, the West Midlands was the name of the metropolitan county, but it's also the name of the sort of wider region, including, like, Shropshire and Warwickshire and so on. It's like, just give them different names, guys. This is not helpful. The other one, of course, is the Tees Valley, home of the sainted Sue Jeffrey, who sadly, I believe, is not standing as Labour's candidate this time around.
No, it is a woman who has an alliterative name, which I did make a note of when I came in, and I've already forgotten. Jo Jacobs, who runs a charity. So, I mean, the interesting thing about the Tees Valley is that no one expected Ben Houchen to win.
Including Ben Houchen.
It symbolised on the night in 2017 just what a bad set of local elections it was for the Labour Party. Labour then clawed back a lot of that ground in time for the 2017 general election. Then you had in December 2019 an election which was basically, to all intents and purposes, like the election that people expected to get in 2017 but did not arrive for various reasons. Now, so the reason why this is all very interesting is that, you know, why are the opponents to Sadiq Khan either from minor parties or fairly rubbishy? Because Sadiq's poll lead scared off anyone halfway decent from the Conservative Party for running. You know, Sean Bailey is very much what you get in an electoral cycle when everyone of substance and stature goes, do you know what? I think I'll be washing my hair that election rather than potentially losing on the first round. It no longer looks like Sadiq Khan will win on the first round. It, however, still looks nailed on certain he will win on the second round. Ditto, why has the Conservative Party still yet to select a candidate in Greater Manchester? Because Andy Burnham is widely believed to have done a very good job in that area. He already outperformed Labour in 2017. I think everyone expects, and indeed, you know, I spoke to one Conservative who's very into the localism agenda, and they said, well, we've all got to hope that Andy Burnham does very well because he deserves to. And if this stuff is going to work, and I think they're entirely correct, if devolution to Metro Mayors is going to work, they need to become their own political ecosystems, right? They can't just do, you know, the problem local councils always have is, although good local councils can escape national swings slightly, they can't escape them very much, so it doesn't lend itself to great governance. The hope, of course, is that you have these mayors and then they become their own political ecosystems, and that allows them to deliver effectively.
I wrote a piece years ago, God knows when, I think it was before the first round of these of the Greater Manchester election in 2017, about how there were certain similarities between Andy Burnham and Sadiq Khan as politicians. They both kind of talk slightly in sound bites. They both tend to sort of be a bit, you know, they shift with the direction of the broader debate and so on. They're not necessarily ideological. They both like a good quote. And I wrote a piece saying, well, why is it that this strategy has worked quite well for Sadiq Khan, but it's failing miserably for Andy Burnham? Not long after that, Andy Burnham won the Greater Manchester mayoral election. He didn't just win it, he won it incredibly well. So I don't know the extent to which that was an example of me being massively wrong about something, or to which it's an example of actually, that is a very good strategy if you're standing as mayor.
So I actually think it was and is completely right? And then, okay, yes, Andy Burnham is from the right of the Labour Party, Sadiq Khan is from the middle of it. But broadly, they were both people who recognised there is this Corbyn wave, you can be on it or underneath it, and they did everything in order to maximise their chances of winning their respective selections. They then won their selections and then won their elections fairly handily. Sadiq Khan doing about as well as you'd expect a generic Labour candidate to do, with the exception of among London's Jewish community, where he did an awful lot of very hard work and was very vocal on the issue of Labour anti-Semitism.
And the first thing he did once he had the job was to go to a Holocaust memorial service,
yeah,
right? Like he took that very seriously.
Whereas, you know, Andy Burnham hugely outperformed the Labour Party in every metric, on local elections, on the state, just by every measure you care to name. But Andy has also been an incredibly effective mayor, right? Mm. He's, you know, he's used the bully pulpit of it well to advocate for more powers. He's, you know, he's done some very interesting things with the powers he has. He's, you know, he's been unafraid to pick fights with, you know, his own local party, you know, launching this, you know, this report into Operation Augusta, which was the failed attempt to bring anyone to book for grooming young girls in, I won't say 2004. Now, it's a really important report. It's brilliant and it's happening. But ultimately, this is a report which, yeah, and phase two will be even more so, which is primarily going to end up focusing, yes, on some national policies, but also will end up focusing on Labour-run authorities, right? That is a kind of thing very few politicians do. And I think it's striking that Andy Burnham has sat there doing some quite significant things in terms of how he uses his powers, and people are still like, lol, Andy Burnham, what a joke. Yet Sadiq Khan, I'm sorry, his record going into this re-election is what? A buses fair policy that he stole from Tessa Jowell, who stole from Caroline Pidgeon, the Liberal Democrat spokesman on the Assembly.
I think it is
a striking example of a North-South bias that more people do not go, oh, hasn't Andy Burnham said some interest? You know, why isn't Andy Burnham still a figure of substance within Labour's internal debates? I think he unarguably has a right to be so.
I think you can overthink this. It is purely because, like, all the media is based in London, and so we're aware of what the London mayor is doing. We're not necessarily aware of what the mayor of Greater Manchester is doing. That's not good. That says bad things about us as an industry. But I think the explanation is actually quite simple.
I know. I'm not convinced by this theory. And obviously, you know, it's one that's advanced by lots of people, including several media organisations which are based outside of London. But the reason why I think that falls down is that's a good explanation for why Sadiq Khan would have a larger profile compared to Andy Burnham. But you can't really say that the coverage of Sadiq Khan in national outlets, there are obviously exceptions, City Metric, Dave Hill's On London blog, but you can't really say that in general there is an awareness of the ways that Sadiq Khan's record has fallen down.
No, people don't tend to write about policy very much.
Yeah, the coverage of, and yeah, one of the reasons why, you know, I think there are lots of things of the kind of devolution agenda which I'm very pro, but I think the one I'm most sceptical of is when people go, oh, if you move bits of the media out, coverage of those parts of the world will improve. It's just like, well, tell that to, you know, the millions of people in London who have poisoned air, or the people in Grenfell Tower, or indeed anyone who would like Sadiq Khan's record to receive some meaningful scrutiny beyond, is the mayor of London responsible for a rise in crime as occurring all across the United Kingdom.
But I think we're conflating two different things here. There's like, how much do you cover something, or how much do you cover someone, like the mayoralty as an institution, what Sadiq has said, what Andy Burnham has said, and there's how much do you cover policy. And like, the media being based largely in London means that we're all more likely to pay attention when Sadiq stands up and says something stupid, or, you know, comes up with a funny line to attack Donald Trump or whatever. But this doesn't suddenly make everyone interested in the air pollution policy.
I do also think one of the things that Sadiq has been incredibly good at is he speaks to a kind of, all electorates are deeply parochial in their own ways. One of the ways that the London electorate is parochial is it likes to believe that it is sophisticated and worldly and the best city in the country and the world. And Sadiq, just as Boris Johnson did, is very good at kind of tapping into that who's like us, nobody aspect. And there isn't yet, I think, an equivalent sort of, well, and I think that is the thing that a London-based media does pick up on, because lots of people in the media do also have that kind of who's like us, nobody. But anyway, let's get back onto the other mayoralties. So there's the Tees Valley, where the kind of fascinating thing about that is Labour has treated that as if it's very winnable again. They have selected, you know, this person who ran a charity.
Jesse Jones, by the way.
Oh, well. But, you know,
you remember two-thirds of the name.
Close but no cigar. But, you know, it's a serious candidacy, and it's a candidacy which is one of a party which thinks it can win. It's fascinating to find out if it will, because, yes, they did very badly in 2019. However, 2019 was a landslide defeat for the Labour Party. We know that outside of the London mayoralty and the two devolved parliaments, there is not much of a separate political ecosystem in local government yet. Ben Houchen has done, I think, a lot better than most people, certainly than you and I expected.
Yeah, I mean, my sense of Houchen is the kind of, he ran that sort of quite trolley campaign, trolley as in like an internet troll rather than like a thing you push your shopping in, campaign in 2017, saying stuff like, well, why don't we nationalise the airport so we can get more flights? Or, you know, it's that kind of slightly kooky stuff to get headlines as a profile raiser rather than because you thought he was going to win. And then once he actually won, it's like, oh, crap, now I have to actually run this combined authority. And it's turned out to be not that bad. Like, he's actually, like, come up with some interesting ideas on, like, economic development and that kind of stuff. Yeah, he's actually been taking it much more seriously than it looked like he would.
And he has, you know, semi-regrettably, actually has revived the airport, which is great from an economic perspective. You know, I'm not going to use this to be yet another podcast in which Stephen's views on airport expansion get another sort of tedious airing. But
no, please do. We've got time to fill.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things where I think it's, obviously it's good for the Tees Valley. I think it's bad for the United Kingdom as a whole, which allows me to effortlessly segue onto another mayor, another Conservative mayor in another place, which, I mean, so again, West Mids, you would feel, looking at, you know, very close margin on a very bad set of local elections for the Labour Party, you would assume that it will be difficult for Andy Street to win re-election, although the Labour Party has had a hilariously casual approach to selecting its candidate.
Has it got one yet?
It doesn't have one yet. It is still unclear at time of writing whether it will be Pete Lowe, local authority leader, Salma Yacoub, formerly of Respect, whose candidacy has caused a lot of ruffled feathers in the Labour Party, or Liam Byrne, former cabinet minister, MP for, I really want to say, Hodge Hill.
I think it was Birmingham Hodge Hill,
Yeah.
Who is not, I mean, my sense of Liam Byrne is he's not a bad chap, but he does kind of like stumble from gaff to gaff. He was the guy of the good luck, there's no money left note, which was a bit unreasonable on the part of his Conservative successor to kind of...
Well, the problem wasn't his Conservative successor, because he and Philip Hammond are good mates.
Was it a Lib Dem who did that?
Yeah, so he left it for Philip Hammond, who was his opposition shadow, and they had got on really well, and they had talked about departing it. I think it was a foolish joke to make, because...
It was very obviously a joke.
But it's not one you should write down. Let's say Cameron had won, decided that he needed to put Philip Hammond somewhere else, and you end up with someone else. Yeah, like, yes, the fact you end up with David Laws choosing to weaponise it gives it a kind of, you know, personal, you know, lib-lab, intra-beef sort of issue. But, you know, it was always a hostage to fortune. But I think in general, right, he's someone who could obviously do the role. He's, you know, a serious political figure. And by selecting him, Labour would guarantee that they would get slightly more coverage.
Because he is a bit of a name.
Because he's a bit of a, you know, which obviously helps if you are not the incumbent. And again, this is why I say it segues to the plane thing. One of the things Andy Street has been really impressive about, given that the electoral profile of the average Conservative voter, both in the West Midlands and indeed across the country, is not, shall we say, well optimised to taking climate change seriously, because a lot of it are motorists, is he has, you know, advocated and won investment to expand the Birmingham tram, a hugely important way to make transport in the conurbation greener and easier.
It's so car-based, the West Midlands, more than most of the other big conurbations. It's really difficult to get around there without a car.
Yeah, he's been really quite brave in supporting congestion charging, considering, one of the interesting things in the London mayoralty is Sean Bailey, the Conservative candidate, is essentially kind of running a campaign that for the most part has been like a kind of weird exercise in every bit of the Tory id that could almost be laboratory designed to be like, so what is the core vote in London? With the exception of the low emission zone, where actually the GLA Conservatives have had a very responsible and sensible measure. Yeah, they've kind of carped a bit about the implementation, but they supported it under Boris Johnson. They're continuing to support it now. And Sean Bailey hasn't really played politics over it. Now, of course, the only reason that's surprising is that Sean Bailey, as a overall bid for the mayoralty, seems so profoundly uninterested both in the things you need to do to win the London mayoralty and in putting forward serious policies that you could enact if you were the London mayor. But, of course, one of the reasons why you can do that in London is that, broadly, London has reached the happy place that we want all of our major conurbations to reach, which is a place where car ownership is a choice for most people, and then you can gradually, through pulling various policy levers, incentivize people becoming car free and gradually reduce people's dependency on the motor car. Now, if we want to achieve our carbon targets, Birmingham is going to have to get into the West Mids, and that whole conurbation is going to have to get that zone too. But it's a much longer journey, and I think it's very impressive that Andy Street has not gone, actually, I hate congestion charging. He has sort of leaned into that and been a very strong advocate for all of that kind of thing. So he starts, I mean, one of the really interesting things about it isn't it feels to me like the election results all ought to result in the incumbent being re-elected. You'd expect Andy Burnham to be re-elected just because it's Greater Manchester. We'd hope, because his record has been very good, that he would kind of, I think it would be good for devolution as an agenda as a whole, if it was shown that someone doing a very good job in that continues to outperform what we'd expect, you know, a generic candidate with that colour of rosette to do. We would similarly kind of expect, all things being equal, given that they're first-term incumbents who've got fairly decent records to protect, Andy Street and Ben Houchen to be re-elected. And then we would expect Sadiq Khan, who doesn't have much of a record to defend, but is very good at embodying, you know, Dennis Healey once said that the reason why Eisenhower beat Adlai Stevenson is because Americans like to have a king as well as a president. And ultimately, I think there is a strong thing that lots of people, particularly indigenous Londoners like ourselves, like to have a king as well as a mayor. And Sadiq is a past master at tapping into that. But I think the fascinating thing about all of them, right, is they are integral to... This is a really exciting time if you're into devolution. You have a prime minister who has done that job, buys into the ways that job can change things, has never met an infrastructure project that he didn't like, and also has won a bunch of seats that, rightly or wrongly, many Conservatives think they need to deliver economic improvements for those constituencies in order to hold them in 2024. And so this is a really exciting moment if you're pro-devolution or any of that stuff, in which you've got to hope that the voters will, there'll be a higher turnout than there was in 2017, and hopefully a sign that they are all developing into their own unique political ecosystems rather than just people kick the incumbents of the governing party, because that's what people do in local elections.
I mean, I agree with all that. I am very into devolution, as you all know. I think it's tremendously exciting. We can talk about trams. But I can't quite get my head around, given all that, why has the Labour Party not selected a candidate for what should be a winnable, massive winnable mayoralty for them? Like, the West Midlands is the biggest outside London. It's slightly bigger than Greater Manchester. And Sean Simon, who was... not a great candidate, let's be honest with ourselves. He was pretty rubbish. It wasn't a shock to me that Andy Street beat him. Came within, I think, 0.4% of winning that. This, even now, even after last December's election, this should be a totally winnable election for Labour. Why have they not nominated a bloody candidate yet?
Factionalism? I mean, ultimately, that whole thing is about parts of Labour's ruling faction wanting to find a way to defeat Liam Byrne. Obviously, other parts, so John McDonnell has endorsed Liam Byrne, partly because of they get on quite well at a personal level, partly because They agree on lots of devolution related bits of politics.
As the senior figures on Labour's radical left go, McDonnell was always the pragmatist, wasn't he? He was the one who, like...
Well, I mean, I also think there's probably an element, you know, without wishing to be unduly cynical, although that is, let's face it, my middle name, there's an element of you get someone who's not of your politics, you move them from a safe seat to a metro mayoralty, you control the selection for the safe seat. Hello, you've increased your parliamentary numbers by one. But, you know, because that view is not mainstream within the people who currently, at time of recording, although obviously that may change in April, control pretty much all of the levers of power in the Labour Party, we have this very long selection process, which is designed to slightly disadvantage the fact that you would kind of assume that because people have heard of Liam Byrne, he will win out on that selection. But it does, of course, have the added consequence, and it makes it harder for anyone, be it Liam Byrne, Salma Yacoub, whoever, to win the election afterwards.
Because in an ideal world, they would have had their candidate in place a year ago, going around like pointing at potholes and looking sad, right? Like this.
So I think it's interesting to compare and contrast the Conservative approach to their selection in London and the Labour approach to the selection in West Midlands. Because I think I think they both went at the wrong time. The Conservatives, in electing so early, one, they ended up electing at what now turns out to have been. Now, it may be that Sadiq Khan's popularity rebounds in May, or his second term has a huge record delivery, and we're talking in 2022 of Sadiq Khan, you know, of Khan mania, right? That's possible. But the Tories essentially chose to select a point when Sadiq Khan was regularly, yeah, every indication was he was going to win in the first round. Now, unsurprisingly, that meant that, because they actually, considering they have so few MPs in London, they've actually got a really deep bench of, like, deeply plausible people in Parliament who could have done it. Ed Vasey would have been a brilliant candidate for them. Justine Greening would have been a brilliant candidate for them. You actually could go for someone who represented an out-of-London seat, but was, you know, kind of quite London-friendly, you know.
Well, Boris Johnson was an out-of-London seat when he became a candidate, wasn't he?
I realise I'm saying this and I keep listing people who are no longer in the Conservative Party for one reason or another, but, you know, someone like, say, Nick Bowles, right? Mm. You know, committed supporter of Brexit, but of a soft Brexit, committed advocate for the right to die, you know, loads of liberal bona fides. You know, these are all candidates who, at the least, you would have thought then, them running, they would have been able to give Sadiq Khan a proper fright, and they would, I think, definitely have generated lots of comment on the kind of, well, you know, I'm going to vote Sadiq Khan, but Ed Vasey is a great guy. And there are lots of changes in the Conservative Party since then, which has meant that those candidates have become unavailable. But one of the reasons why people who did not feel their careers were well served in the May administration went, do you know what, I'm okay, thanks, is because they did it quite so early on. Whereas the Labour Party sort of done the opposite extreme in the West Midlands, where they're going to select someone, will immediately go, and then it will essentially immediately be into the election. So they're hobbled from the get-go. Now, if both of those parties had selected in, say, October last year, June last year, you give them a decent run-up, but you probably maximise your chances of getting a properly heavyweight candidate. And this, sorry, I'm aware that I'm doing my kind of Nicholas Parsons tribute, talking without hesitation, but probably lots of repetition.
It's a crime that man didn't get a knighthood before he died. But anyway,
true. But one of the ways that the Cameron-era Conservatives have set a precedent that neither the Labour Party in any incarnation nor the post-Cameron Conservatives have yet equal is real ambition for people they recruited to run in mayoralties. From basically, you know, kind of like putting Boris in a headlock and going, you know, come on, you are going to run for mayor, to wooing Andy Street, you know, a brilliant candidate, both because he's done a fairly good job of doing it, but also because the guy ran John Lewis. My favourite fact about the West Midlands conurbation is that in the focus groups that both parties have run on it, voters will say, unprompted, I really like that John Lewis guy. He's doing a good job. They actually think his name is John Lewis in some of the focus groups. Because, yeah, understandably, he talks about it lots. Yeah, I mean,
when I interviewed him for this very podcast about 3 years ago now, the interview was conducted in the cafe of the big John Lewis at New Street Station.
I mean, it's a great John Lewis. I always make a point of going to it when conference is held in Birmingham. If you think then they're into that one, seriously, I can't remember which election it was I was in Solihull, but I look back through my notes and I think almost every voter mentioned that you arrive in Solihull and people are like, welcome to Solihull, home of John Lewis. And it's just like, we have one in London. And they're like, welcome to Solihull, we've got a John Lewis. I honestly think they were probably Jesus probably had disciples who were less into Christ than people in Solihull are into their John Lewis. So he's a great candidate, and it was a huge level of ambition to want a candidate of that quality. Whereas, I mean, Sean Simon, I have nothing against the guy, but an MEP and a junior minister in the Blair Brown government is just not at that quality level.
He just wasn't very impressive, and he was so complacent about it. Like, the same day, I think, they interviewed Andy Stewart. Or maybe it was different. But anyway, they went out in the same podcast. I interviewed Sean Simon, and he was very complacent about it. Like, he was like, you know, everyone always says that Liverpool and Manchester are very Labour. Well, if you look at it, it's not that different here. Obviously, Labour's going to win. There was just kind of no sort of concern about the fact that there wasn't a hunger.
Yeah, I mean, I think there was an astonishing level of kind of... I mean, because I remember hearing from, you know, a senior official on that campaign, and they just kind of said to me, like, oh, they basically went, and I'm being slightly crude in this, but what they essentially said was, oh, it'll be fine, we'll turn out the Asian vote. Which, I mean, when I mentioned something a bit like that to Birmingham MP, they just went, a lot of the Asian vote in the conurbation votes Conservative, and even if it all voted for one party, it's not big enough to elect one candidate, and crucially, a lot of it votes Conservative. It just was an astonishingly... And I just think, you know...
It's inept.
Yeah, and I do think it's surprising the level of... You know, given that, you know, local government has been the engine of, you know, so many different eras and so many different wings of Labour appointment, it's been a real crucible of innovation. I think the kind of lack of interest in going, OK, let's actually run this stuff. You know, who is one of the most interesting people in the 2019 intake? James Murray, who worked on housing policy in City Hall.
It was Deputy Mayor for Housing.
Deputy Mayor for Housing. Oh, yeah,
prior to that was my councillor in Islington, and got my gate fixed.
Yeah.
So I was very in favour of his appointment as housing czar, because he clearly knew his stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think it's surprising to me that there hasn't been more ambition to recruit that candidate, particularly because in the case of Corbynism, right, it's not the only problem Corbynism had from 2015 to 2019, but one of them was that a lot of talented people in their 30s and 40s had been unable to get selected, 30s, 40s, 50s, had been unable to get selected from, you know, your kind of late, early 90s to mid-noughties. And so you had a parliamentary party which was quite old or young, untested, or in some cases just not up to it. But there was a lot of kind of Corbynite talent in the third sector that they could have tapped up to run for some of these things. They could have brought in through the Lords, and there was such a real disinterest in doing so and using any of these elections to be a showcase for Corbynism in office. And that lack of ambition is a problem not just for them, but for the whole of the Labour Party, really.
Please mind the gap between the train and the platform.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
But there's a couple of things I want to get through before we wrap up. Firstly, it's not a Metro Mayoralty, but I think we should touch on Bristol, where I believe Martin Rees is up for re-election.
Yeah, I mean, I know this is a deeply terrible opinion, but I mean, Bristol, brilliant city. I really should manufacture a concern in it, because that way the NS would pay for me to go to what's a brilliant, lovely city. But...
You don't find it an interesting race?
Yeah, I realise, as TB said in his final Prime Minister's question, someone asked him about something about the church, because I'm not that bothered about that, frankly. But...
All right, well, Stephen Bush hates Bristol. You heard it here first.
Well, I think one of the interesting sort of...
I was in Bristol at the weekend. I went to see the Clifton Suspension Bridge, which I've never seen before, which is magnificent. Go see it if you've not been.
Yeah, no, it is a brilliant city. But I think one of the weird missed opportunities about devolution in that part of the world, right, is that... Then they've created this weird thing which looks a bit like Avon but isn't quite.
It's missing, which is it, North Somerset?
Yeah, like the kind of weird sort of Bath and Bristol kind of like joint thing which sits above the Bristol mayoralty.
Where the Metro Mayor is Tim Bowles, the Conservative. OK, well, that actually gives me a very natural segue to my next question, which is not all the Metro mayoralties that are up in 2017 are up this year, because Cambridgeshire and Peterborough and the West of England, which is the sort of Avon impersonator we were just describing, are on a different cycle. I was wondering if you like nerdy stuff like this. Can you explain that? Why are they holding them next year?
Oh, so the rationale is, right, so these Metro mayoralties have all been cut down, right? They've had three-year terms, not the 4 years they'll have from there on. Is that they are all, what's that abbreviation, shortening, PUAs, which I always want to call PUAs, and the Centre for Cities is fond of, right? So they're all...
Primary urban areas.
Yeah, they're all basically urban conurbations now. Like, obviously, London is an urban conurbation, yeah, a sort of series of small towns and villages that has become a city which has a very strong combined identity. The West Midlands, yeah, that kind of conurbation from Birmingham to Wolverhampton. When you go through, which you should, the tram's brilliant, you feel very virtuous, you have a nice view. But ultimately, it is slightly wild to me whenever I cover elections or just visit that part of the world, Yeah, almost virulent sense than people in Wolverhampton have that they live in a different city, when it is basically 2 minutes of green grass separating the two of them, right? Mm. It literally would be like if you arrived in Hackney and someone went, here I am in London, and they're like, I am not in London, I will not hear any of that imperialism from people in Westminster, just like, you're in London, mate. But yeah, they're basically all kind of primarily urban conurbations. And so the idea is you have all of the kind of big city elections in one cycle, and this will hopefully in the long term engender a kind of sort of thing where, because obviously there's this problem, right, then people primarily talk about London and then they go, oh, and also there's these metro mayoralties. Mm-hmm. And the idea is, and it kind of creates a sort of broader civic and national awareness than we elect mayors and they happen and they're the big centrepiece of this set of local elections.
It's interesting that the West of England is not considered one of them, because I can never remember whether Avon was a metropolitan county or not. I assume not. But then it's less urban than those, but it is still sort of greater Bristol, isn't it?
But I mean, I think that's why I think that the Avon one is poorly conceived, because you can broadly see, so Cambridgeshire and Peterborough even actually is primarily a rural conurbation.
These two medium-sized cities at either end of the conurbation.
Yeah. Now, of course, there's...
Conurbation, the, county, right?
Of course, one of the fascinating urban trends in the United Kingdom is Cambridge is one of the cities that is successfully growing and building houses. It's becoming a proper city, and I think it's one of the things I suspect will happen, maybe even by the next election, is a bunch of Conservative MPs in Cambridgeshire will lose their seats, another one will become marginal, and everyone will go, how did that happen in this home of traditional conservatism? And someone will like illustrate it with like a picture of like some great rural expanse. And be like, well, mate, actually, those are all full of like nice new build homes with scientists and researchers who are employed either directly or indirectly by Cambridge University. So it's not really surprising that the Conservatives have lost.
But this feels an under-discussed trend. Like, I can't remember what it was before 97, but I have a sense that Cambridge was maybe a little bit marginal. It's safe Labour now.
Oh, so Cambridge was a 97 gain or a 1992 gain, but you know, it was solidly conservative throughout most of the Thatcher government.
That was my sense. I just wasn't certain of it, and it basically followed the path that Canterbury is now following, and I think Oxford's done the same thing. York Inner, maybe, was York Inner ever Tory?
I'm not sure if York. I mean, it's actually, so it's maddeningly called York Central, because why wouldn't you have a York Central and a York Outer, not a York Inner and a York Outer? Who knows? But I think York Centre is one of those ones where you look at an 83 and you're like, wow, that was close, rather than it actually tipping. But yeah, like all of these places kind of, you know, and obviously the global problem for the left and centre left is that their vote voters are, due to economic trends, concentrating themselves in ever less efficient places under any sort of majoritarian electoral system.
Sure, but what I'm kind of wondering is why it doesn't feel like we've had a discussion about this. All the discussion about, you know, the crumbling red wall and all those kind of seats in the north that have always been Labour and have just started going Tory. And that's largely for demographic reasons, that basically, like, young people get degrees and move out, leaving older, whiter, Brexity people there. I mean, it's massively oversimplification, but that's a big part of it. And we talk a lot about that. I don't feel like we're talking as much about these sort of, you know, well-to-do university cities that would once have been quite Tory and now pretty safe Labour.
So I think there are a couple of reasons why we don't do that, right? The first is that there's always a bias in political commentary towards what has happened, and it tends to be quite based on the headline of what's happened, right? So let's take the 2019 election. Big Conservative majority of 80, but you only need 20,000 Liberal Democrat votes, so 0.1% of the Liberal Democrat vote to be better allocated, and then suddenly you have no Conservative majority. So just all of your places like Winchester, Guildford, which are just right. so close to flipping, you just need all of those marginal calls to go the other way, and suddenly you've got quite a different political situation. And then I suspect we would be over in debt. Yeah, people would be going, well, this shows in the Conservative Party. Yeah, you saw it a bit before the election. You know, I wrote a list of kind of misconceptions about the election before it, you know, before it happened, where I went, you know, people kept saying, oh, how can the Conservatives win without X? Well, actually, there were loads and loads of ways. I mean, they did nearly lose Kensington. Yeah, there were loads of ways for them to win without Kensington, just as there were loads of ways for this successful electoral strategy to have gone belly up. And people are quite bad at being alive to how marginal something actually is because they just go, oh, well, look how many seats of it there were. I think the other reason why people don't talk it up, so there are three, right? The second is, ultimately, at the moment is obviously always an important qualifier, but at the moment, what the Conservative Party has lost in places like Southeast Cambridgeshire being a LibCon marginal, in places like High Peak, where you had a Labour candidate who had repeatedly been involved in a series of rows about Labour anti-Semitism, so where the Labour Party therefore was running considerably weaker than it was nationally, and actually a very strong and impressive candidate in the new Conservative MP for High Peak, who'd, you know, run in a marginal before, so kind of everything you would want in terms of having an experienced candidate, won very narrowly. Why? Because High Peak is basically becoming, to Manchester and to Sheffield, what Canterbury is to London. Why did Reading West and Reading East, well, why did Matt Rowler keep his seat? Why did Alok Sharma, you know, remain marginal when everyone else was increasing? Well, again, the Londonification of those seats. But because at the moment, the price of the voters the Conservatives have decided they're not interested in is worth the product, which is the seats they have won. At the moment, no one's going, hey guys, but there is quite a big downside risk here, and it wouldn't take that much. The Labour Party could plausibly force a hung parliament, losing by 8 points. So that's one of the reasons. And then the third reason is to do with the Labour Party itself, which is that the good thing about first past the post, if you're a party doing electoral strategy, is you don't have to sit there going, oh, we lost these voters and these voters. First past the post does regrettably mean some voters matter more. So it doesn't really matter why the Conservative Party won Wakefield, Bishop Auckland, Redcar. The Labour Party does need to regain at least some of them to form a government, let alone to win a majority government. But I do think there's a strong element within the Labour Party that basically it's okay to want to win back Wakefield if the problem is that a bunch of like horny-handed sons of toil who worked down a mine for 30 years have suddenly gone, I don't like that Jeremy Corbyn, and then, you know, they just need a Labour Party which is radical on economics but is more robust about blowing people up. That's kind of pure almost. Whereas if the problem is then you have voters who are okay, their income in terms of size is not very large, but their mortgage payments are even lower, they have security of tenure, whether by being in social housing or being owner-occupiers, who feel fairly comfortably off, all things considered. If it's a problem of how those people relate economically as well as culturally to the Labour Party, that's impure somehow, right? Yeah, and I think that's one of the reasons why the Labour equivalent of what... So, because obviously the Conservatives did lose votes while gaining them in this election. The other reason why people don't talk about that is that the second you do, if you're the Labour Party, you have to kind of acknowledge that maybe the solution is not just like being another version of yourself, which, you know, just being yourself in a more authentic way, which in different ways is broadly the snake oil that is being sold by Keir Starmer, Lisa Nandy, Rekki Long Bailey, and was being sold by Jess Phillips.
Okay, I mean, I that was a much more comprehensive answer than I was expecting to whatever it was that I originally asked. I mean, I kind of feel like the story of the last 10 years is after every election we've overcorrected. So after 2010, the Tories can't get a majority. After 2015, it was like, how can Labour ever win again? After 2017, it was like, are the Tories stuffed? And now it's like, how can the Tories ever be beaten? And it's just like every time we're kind of...
Well, I think 2015 is the one I always kind of think it's worth sort of, yeah, because I think there is definitely a problem of overcorrection. Although I do actually think one of the things which was very good about the coverage of the 2019 election across the piece is I think that people did correctly go, look, all of the evidence suggests the Conservatives will win, but here are the ways it could go wrong, rather than the kind of like way that people covered the 2015 and 2017 elections, where in 2015 it was all very much like the Conservatives have a slightly wild manifesto, but it's all designed to be negotiated away by the Lib Dems. You know, don't pay attention to it. Ed Miliband will definitely take power with the SNP. And in 2017, you basically had governing parties going to win by loads. And here's what its manifesto means for your house. Frustrated agent of change, Jeremy Corbyn, had some nice-sounding policies. But who cares? We don't need to scrutinise them in any detail. 2019, I think, was an election which, although a lot of the policy coverage, particularly from the BBC, was quite weak, did at least start from an appropriate level of ambiguity about who could win.
Yeah, there was scrutiny on both sides, which was unusual in recent British history. Just a couple of things very briefly, sort of housekeeping points. Firstly, you will probably know out there by now that I'm leaving the New Statesman this week, and I've had a tremendous amount of fun. It's been great to work here, and I'm still going to keep writing and doing some bits and bobs, so I'm not vanishing completely. There will continue to be Skylines for a little bit, because we've got some stuff to get through. What happens after that is still up in the air, but it may continue under a new team. Who knows? The other thing is, for fans of listening to Stephen and I witter on about politics for frankly more minutes than we intended to when we came in here, I think it's probably a good moment to trail our new podcast, which should be launching in about a month's time. Stephen, do you want to tell us about that?
So it's called Prime Ministerial, and you'll have guessed from the title, and it's about the chances of the Duchy of Lancaster. No, it's about the last, I'm going to say six, which
is
going to be
six,
wrong.
Yeah.
Wow, the last six prime ministers in reverse chronological order. So starting with Theresa May, ending in Margaret Thatcher. So, you know, whether you want to call it, you know, the market turn or the era of the new right or the neoliberal moment or three completely...
you know, British politics, the John Elledge years, as I like to think
of it. Yeah, the John Elledge years. You know, we're talking with, you know, the various kind of, you know, their staffers, officials who worked with them, about, you know, the politics of the era. And we're kind of sort of going, what we're basically doing is like, what did this person want to achieve, and how effective were they at being the best version of Margaret Thatcher, as it were?
And it's, you know, it's been a bit of a long-term project, put it that way. We started interviews for this some time ago, but we've interviewed some fantastic people for it. We got to interview Peter Mandelson, which is obviously a very great honour to meet the Prince of Darkness himself.
Yeah, Jonathan Hill, I thought, was actually really interesting. So he was someone who people may know him as David Cameron's penultimate appointment as EU Commissioner, but he was also a SPAD, essentially, at the heart of Downing Street in the run-up to and immediately after 1992, as it all started to crumble. Really interesting insights. I thought Gavin Barwell was very interesting as well, actually.
Jonathan Hill, we should say, was from the John Major episode. The other guest on the John Major episode was someone I was very excited to meet, which is the satirist John O'Farrell, who wrote, what's it called, Things Can Only Get Better, was like one of my sort of... one of the very formative books for me, sort of learning about recent British political history back in the day. But yeah, no, it's. I think it's going to be a fantastic series. We're kind of looking forward to hearing the finished product very soon, and it should be out by the end of the month. So thank you for listening, and look out for that. Thank you, Stephen.
Guys, I thought this was your last one.
I'm going to leave that in. You've been listening to Skylines, the podcast from City Metric, the New Statesman City site. It was presented and recorded by me, John Elledge, and produced by Nick Hilton. You can find Skylines every 2 weeks on iTunes, Acast, or whatever other app you use to get your podcast. And while you're there, why not leave us a nice review to tell other people we're here? It, you know, it really helps people discover the show, and I'm a megalomaniac, so the more people I can get listening to this, the better, really. We'll see you in 2 weeks. Thanks for listening.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free.
That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.